I want to begin this podcast by telling you a story about a man I bet you've never heard of. His name was Richard Paul Pavlik. In November 1960, Pavlik decided that he wanted to assassinate John F. Kennedy. Kennedy had just been elected President of the United States, but he hadn't yet been inaugurated, and Pavlik wanted to make sure he never would be. Pavlik was 73 years old. He was a World War I veteran and a retired postal worker. He was also a bigot and a religious crackpot. He hated the Kennedys, and he was damned if he was going to let a Catholic become president. So, just after Kennedy won the election, Pavlik went to a hardware store and bought 10 sticks of dynamite. In those days, you could buy dynamite at a hardware store. He also bought 4 cans of gasoline, a battery, some copper wire, and some blasting caps and detonators. He packed up his home in New Hampshire, left his property to the local youth group, and spent the next month following Kennedy around the country in his Buick, looking for opportunities to blow him up. Pavlik's idea was to use his Buick as a mobile suicide bomb. He packed the trunk with dynamite, attached a blasting cap to each stick, rigged them to the battery, and ran a length of copper wire from the battery to a detonator switch in the car's front seat. By early December, Pavlik had stalked Kennedy to Palm Beach, Florida. Kennedy's father, Joseph, had a mansion there, and Jack had brought his young family down for a vacation. On the morning of Sunday, December the 11th, Pavlik parked outside the Kennedy compound and waited. He knew that the president-elect went to mass every Sunday morning, and as soon as Jack emerged from the mansion's front gate, Pavlik planned to trigger his bomb. But when Kennedy came out that morning, he didn't come out alone. His wife Jackie and their daughter Caroline came out to see him off. Pavlik drew the line at killing Kennedy in front of his wife and kid, so he didn't flip the switch. Instead, he followed Kennedy to the church. When he got there, he transferred a stick of dynamite to his pocket, attached the detonator switch to his belt, and followed Kennedy inside. During the mass, a Secret Service agent saw Pavlik behaving oddly in one of the back pews, and he escorted him out of the church. Pavlik sat in his car and waited for the service to end. When Kennedy came out, he came within 6 feet of Pavlik's car. But again, Pavlik felt that there were too many women and children around to detonate his bomb. So he drove back to his motel, where he decided to lie low and wait for a better opportunity. But the Secret Service agent at the church had taken note of Pavlik's license plate, and he passed it on to the local police. 4 days later, Pavlik was pulled over in Palm Beach for making an illegal lane change. The traffic cop ran his plate and arrested him. When he opened the trunk of Pavlik's car, he found 7 sticks of dynamite in there. Pavlik never stood trial for his actions. He was judged insane and committed to a mental hospital. He was released in 1967, and he died quietly in 1975. Actually, for all we know, he died very noisily. Not that much is known about Pavlik for the simple reason that his plan to assassinate Kennedy failed instead of succeeding. He made no mark on history. Instead of changing its course, he vanished into its footnotes, as would-be assassins always do when they miss their targets instead of hitting them. Another man I bet you've never heard of is Giuseppe Zangara. Zangara was a 5-foot-tall Italian-born anarchist who tried to shoot Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1933 during an outdoor rally in Miami. Zangara fired 5 shots. All of them missed Roosevelt, partly because Zangara was so short that he had to stand on a wobbly folding chair to aim his pistol over the crowd. But one of his wayward shots did accidentally hit and kill the mayor of Chicago, who was standing beside Roosevelt at the time. "I'm glad it was me, not you," the mayor reportedly said to Roosevelt before dying. Zangara went to the electric chair just a month later, and was apparently quite peeved when he found out that there would be no newsreel cameras there to document his death. Who knows exactly how many times the course of American history has come within inches of being changed by the actions of a violent fanatic. It happened twice in September 1975, when two separate attempts were made on the life of President Gerald Ford in the space of just 17 days. On September the 5th, Ford was shaking hands with people in a Sacramento park when a woman dressed in a flowing red robe stepped forward from the crowd. Her name was Lynette Squeaky Frome, and she was a hardcore disciple of Charles Manson. Frome drew an automatic pistol from her red robe and aimed it point blank at Ford's belly and pulled the trigger. But the gun just clicked. Its magazine was loaded, but Frome had failed to slide around into the gun's chamber. "It didn't go off, can you believe it? It didn't go off," she yelled while onlookers wrestled her to the turf. Just 2 weeks later in San Francisco, a 45-year-old woman named Sarah Jane Moore, who had an interest in radical politics, fired two pistol shots at President Ford from a range of about 40 feet. One bullet missed his head by 5 inches. The other hit a taxi driver in the groin. I could go on giving examples because over the years, many people have tried and failed to assassinate America's commander-in-chief. So far, only 4 people have tried and succeeded. In 1865, John Wilkes Booth shot Abraham Lincoln in Ford's Theatre in Washington, D.C. Lincoln died the next morning. Booth's crime was part of a conspiracy to overthrow Lincoln's government. The Civil War was winding down at the time. The Confederate Southern states had effectively been defeated. Booth was the leader of a small ragtag band of 7 or 8 Confederate conspirators who wanted to revive the Southern cause by striking at Lincoln's presidency. Initially, they planned to kidnap Lincoln from Washington and smuggle him into the South and demand the release of Confederate prisoners of war in exchange for his safe return. But soon, Booth and his co-conspirators scrapped the kidnap plan and came up with the more radical idea of assassinating the 3 most important members of the Lincoln administration simultaneously. While Booth murdered Lincoln, a second assassin would murder the vice president, while a third would kill the Secretary of State. They scheduled all 3 killings for 10:15 on the night of April the 14th, 1865. But only Booth's part of the plot came off. The guy who was supposed to assassinate the Secretary of State stabbed him repeatedly in the face with a Bowie knife, but the secretary happened to be wearing a metal brace on his jaw, which he'd broken just 3 days earlier in an accident. The brace deflected most of the knife's thrusts away from his throat so that instead of being killed, he was just put into a brief coma and disfigured for life. Meanwhile, the guy who was supposed to murder Lincoln's vice president changed his mind at the last moment and went and got drunk instead. If we want to know what a real-life conspiracy to murder an American president looks like, the Lincoln conspiracy should give us a rough idea. 3 more American presidents have been assassinated since Lincoln, none of them as the result of a proven conspiracy. In 1881, an unhinged narcissist named Charles Guiteau shot President James Garfield, who took 11 weeks to die of his infected wounds. In 1901, an anarchist steel worker named Leon Czolgosz shot President William McKinley, who died a week later. And on the 22nd of November 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. Or did he? Right from the start, people found it very hard to believe that Oswald, acting alone, had managed to end the life of the world's most powerful man. The idea that Oswald was just another Giuseppe Zangara with slightly better aim never really caught on. People immediately felt that there had to be more to Kennedy's assassination than met the eye. And that suspicion intensified 2 days after the president's death, when Oswald himself was shot dead in police custody by a Dallas nightclub owner named Jack Ruby. The idea that one lone nut had changed history in Dallas was already hard enough to swallow, but two lone nuts in the space of 2 days seemed seriously over the odds. And so the conspiracy theories flourished in the wake of the Kennedy assassination. As conspiracy theories always do when assassins or terrorists hit their targets instead of missing them. In the decades since Kennedy's death, the opinion polls have consistently shown that more than 50% of Americans believe that Kennedy was murdered by some kind of conspiracy. Sometimes the figure has risen as high as 80%. There's no other case in American history where the conspiratorial view is so mainstream and so respectable. In 2017, an NBC News report exaggerated the truth only slightly when it said that the existence of a conspiracy in the Kennedy assassination is the one thing all Americans agree on. But what if the one thing that all Americans agree on is not actually true? Because it isn't, according to all the available evidence. If you don't know much about Kennedy's murder, I certainly wouldn't blame you for thinking that there must have been some kind of conspiracy behind it, given the stupefying number of books and websites and documentaries that have told us over the years that there was one, and given how sure of themselves the people who believe this seem to be. Where there's so much smoke, there surely must be some kind of fire. But over the course of this podcast, I'm going to show you that it's dangerous to believe that. I'm going to put the claims of conspiracy theory to the test in this podcast, and I think you're going to be surprised by how flimsy those claims turn out to be when we test them against reality. Not only is there no fire here, when we look at all the smoke, we've surely got a right to notice that it's never solidified into any kind of coherent shape. After 60 years of making noise about it, the conspiracy theorists still can't offer us a clear picture of what they think happened in Dallas. They can tell you over and over what didn't happen there, according to them, but they still can't tell you who else killed Kennedy if Oswald didn't. They think the idea that Oswald did it alone is preposterous, but after all these years, they still haven't settled on an alternative story that even they all find plausible, let alone one that's been generally accepted in the world beyond conspiracy theory. If these people had a point, don't you think they'd have made it by now? A shapeless and toxic cloud of smoke is all they've ever really produced in this case. That's what conspiracy theory is. It's smoke without fire. As we clear the smoke of Kennedy conspiracy theory away, we're going to find that there's nothing underneath it except what's been there all along since day one, Lee Harvey Oswald and his rifle. There's no vacancy in this case. This isn't a whodunit, it's a he done it. Mind you, the fact that Oswald unquestionably fired the shots that killed Kennedy doesn't necessarily mean there was no conspiracy. It's important to recognize that there are two basic ways that a conspiracy might have happened in this case. One is that Oswald didn't commit the crime at all. He was set up to take the fall by the real killers. He was a patsy, a sacrificial lamb, as Kevin Costner puts it in Oliver Stone's movie JFK. The other kind of conspiracy that's possible here is a conspiracy that Oswald willingly participated in. In other words, he did do it, but he didn't do it alone. As we're going to see, the idea that Oswald was a patsy is flat out ridiculous. To believe it, you have to ignore so many facts that you effectively have to opt out of reality. But the idea that Oswald had some kind of help or guidance isn't inherently crazy. In fact, it's a legitimate line of inquiry. Over the years, plenty of serious researchers have explored it. They're not the people I'm talking about when I talk about the conspiracy theorists who have shrouded this story in so much smoke. People who look for evidence of conspiracy in good faith and admit that the evidence isn't there when they don't find it don't deserve to be called conspiracy theorists. It's the people who tell you the evidence is there when it isn't that we need to worry about. They're the conspiracy theorists. So what about the possibility that Oswald conspired with other people while planning his crime? Well, it will probably never be proved beyond doubt that he didn't do that, because it's very hard to prove a negative. But what we can fairly say is that after 6 decades of furious investigation from serious researchers and conspiracy theorists alike, nobody has ever been able to find any conclusive evidence that Oswald was involved in any kind of conspiracy. And if that evidence hasn't surfaced by now, it might be time to conclude that it's never going to, because there never was any conspiracy. In any case, until such hypothetical evidence does turn up, the huge trove of actual evidence that we do have gives us ample reason to believe that Oswald did it, and gives us no good reason to believe that he had any help. And one principle that I really want to hammer in this podcast is that if we have no good reason to believe something, we shouldn't believe it. I'm going to tell you 2 main stories then as this podcast unfolds. At one level, I'm going to tell you the story of the luckiest lone nut in American history, the scrawny ex-Marine who changed the world with his $20 rifle, whether we like that fact or not. And as I tell you Oswald's story, I think you're going to be surprised by how unambiguous and watertight the case against him is. I think you're going to be equally surprised by how little need there is to believe that he didn't commit this crime alone. But why should we be surprised by facts that have been sitting on the table of history for almost 60 years now? Well, that's the other story I want to tell you in this podcast. The story of how conspiracy theory has succeeded in making the plain truth about Kennedy's assassination unfamiliar to us. The story of Kennedy conspiracism is the story of the greatest con trick that American conspiracy theory has ever pulled. It's the story of how an open and shut murder case became the single most misunderstood event in American history. How did conspiracy theorists make this happen? If there really is no fire, then how on earth did they generate so much smoke? Who were the people who got this giant con trick started? What were their motives? That's the real mystery we need to solve in this podcast. You could even say it's the other great crime in this story, because obstructing history is a kind of crime. It's like obstructing justice, or like claiming to have won an election that you've actually lost.
All I did is point out the fact that on the cover of the National Enquirer, there was a picture of him and crazy Lee Harvey Oswald having breakfast. The press takes that and they say, Donald Trump and his conspiracy theories, he went out and said his father was with Lee Harvey Oswald and he assassinated the president. What did I do?
That's Donald J. Trump in 2016, jazzing up his presidential run by implying that Ted Cruz's father was somehow involved in the Kennedy assassination. In 2016, Trump got himself all the way to the White House by saying things like that. As I speak in 2022, it remains entirely possible that he'll get himself all the way back into the White House again by saying more things like that. This is where a culture can end up if it spends 60 years telling itself that there's a great unsolved conspiratorial murder at the heart of its political history. The presidency of Donald Trump sounded a giant alarm bell about the real-world dangers of conspiracy theory. There are certain trendy but mediocre academics who reckon that there's nothing wrong with conspiracy theory. They'll tell you that it's a bracingly radical way of resisting dominant narratives and sticking it to the man. But when Donald Trump became the man, and when he took American democracy to the brink of conspiratorial self-destruction, it surely became apparent even to the academics that conspiracy theory can no longer be treated as a harmless parlor game or tolerated as a victimless way of blowing off mental steam. It's a game that can be played by demagogues and tyrants too, as well as by self-styled free thinkers and progressives. I think it's time that we called out the rotten techniques and fallacies of conspiracy theory. And I think it's time we realize that they never lead anywhere good. That's the final thing I hope to achieve with this podcast. I think that if we can get to know one conspiracy theory well enough, we can know them all. If we can understand the epic story of Kennedy conspiracism, we can equip ourselves with the tools we need to recognize the tricks of today's conspiracy theorists and defend ourselves against them. It's going to take me a while to tell the true story of the Kennedy assassination and the story of all the untrue stories that sprang up in its wake. But I want to tell those stories properly, because I think that only by understanding the conspiracy theories of the past can we arm ourselves against the conspiracy theories of the present and the future. My name is David Free, and this is The Ghosts of Dallas. In September 1963, when John F. Kennedy first announced his intention to visit Dallas, his aides were not thrilled. Dallas, at the time, was a hotbed of right-wing discontent. People called it the City of Hate. In October, a month before the assassination, Adlai Stevenson, who was Kennedy's ambassador to the United Nations, went to Dallas to make a speech on UN Day. He got a hostile reception.
Shall we get on with the business of the meeting? Surely, my dear friend, I don't have to come here from Illinois to teach Texas manners, do I?
Things got even uglier when Stevenson's speech was over. As he tried to leave, hostile locals jostled him and spat in his face. Protesters ran at him with their fists flying and had to be tackled by local police. A female protester cracked Stevenson on the head with a wooden placard, drawing blood. The sign that she'd hit him with said, "Adlai, who elected you?" The protests against Stevenson's visit had been organized by a Dallas right-wing rabble-rouser named Edwin Walker. Walker was a former U.S. Army general who was notorious in Dallas for his rabid anti-communism. We need to remember General Walker's name because it's going to come up again in this story in a very big way. When Adlai Stevenson returned from his visit to Dallas, he warned Kennedy's advisers about the ugly and frightening mood there. But Kennedy refused to cancel his trip. On the morning of November the 22nd, the day of his death, the Dallas Morning News published a full-page anti-Kennedy advertisement, which had been paid for by a group of local ratbags who called themselves the American Fact-Finding Committee. The ad's headline said, "Welcome, Mr. Kennedy, to Dallas." The text below accused Kennedy of being soft on communism, among other things. The ad had been printed with a thick black border around it so that it looked like a death notice. "Can you imagine a paper doing a thing like that?" said Kennedy, when one of his advisers showed him the ad. Then he turned to his wife Jackie and said, "We're heading into nut country today." What Kennedy meant, and didn't need to say, was that they were heading into right-wing nut country. And when Kennedy was shot later that day, most Americans instantly assumed that he'd been shot by a local right-wing extremist. And that wasn't an unreasonable assumption. But Dallas contained at least one extremist from the other end of the political spectrum. Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't a right-winger, he was a left-winger. He was a Marxist, which didn't necessarily mean he was a communist, as Oswald himself was at pains to point out.
"No, sir, I'm not a communist, and I think that the red herring and so forth is rather ridiculous."
That's Oswald speaking in August 1963, 3 months before the assassination. He's 23 years old and he's starting to make a modest name for himself as a left-wing street protester. That's why he's on the radio talking to a reporter who's eager to nail down exactly what kind of left-winger Oswald is.
You're a Marxist?
Well, I have studied Marxist philosophy, yes, sir, and also other philosophers.
But are you a Marxist? I think you did admit on an earlier radio interview that you consider yourself a Marxist.
Well, I would very definitely say that I am a Marxist. That is correct. But that does not mean, however, that I'm a communist.
What is the difference between the two?
Well, there's a great deal of difference. That several American parties in several countries are based on Marxism, such as Ghana. Certain countries have characteristics of a socialist system, such as Great Britain with its socialized medicine. These then are the differences between an outright communist country and countries which adhere to leftist or Marxist principles.
Oswald had first become interested in radical politics in his early teens. At the age of 17, he dropped out of high school to join the US Marines. Even while serving in the Marines, he'd made no secret of his left-wing sympathies. The men in his unit called him Comrade, or Oswaldkovich. After a couple of troubled years in the Marines, Oswald was discharged. Then he did something remarkable. In 1959, at the age of 19, he defected to the Soviet Union. Or at least he tried to. He travelled to Moscow via Finland, and immediately after his arrival, he applied to become a Soviet citizen, and he attempted to renounce his American citizenship. Oswald ended up staying in the Soviet Union for almost 3 years, although neither of those requests was ever formally granted. At the American embassy in Moscow, the consul who dealt with Oswald remembered him as one of the most obnoxious young men he'd ever met. What stuck in his head about Oswald was his, quote, overbearing arrogance and insufferable adolescence. Unfortunately for Oswald, the Soviet authorities didn't think much of him either. He had imagined that they would welcome him as some kind of high-quality asset. He thought the KGB would be very interested in hearing all about the secrets that he'd picked up in the Marines while serving as a radar operator. He had visions of studying philosophy and politics at university in Moscow. He thought he might eventually be offered a position in the party or even the Soviet government. But Oswald's security clearance in the Marines hadn't been all that high, and he didn't know any military secrets that the Soviets didn't know already. After debriefing him in Moscow, they sent him off to live in the provincial city of Minsk in Belarus, where he was given work in a radio factory. When he was told that he'd be living in Minsk instead of Moscow, Oswald cried. He lived in Minsk from January 1960 to May 1962. It didn't take him long to realize that the Soviet workers' paradise wasn't all that it was cracked up to be. Among other things, he complained about the lack of nightclubs and 10-pin bowling alleys. A little over a year after he arrived in Minsk, Oswald wrote to the US Embassy in Moscow, seeking permission to return to America. But his application would drag on for another 15 months, partly because Oswald demanded assurances from the embassy that if he did return to the States, he wouldn't be prosecuted for his borderline treasonous attempt to divulge military secrets to the Russians. In March 1961, a month after he'd opened negotiations with the US Embassy, Oswald was at a dance in Minsk when he met a 19-year-old local woman named Marina Prusakova. Oswald proposed to Marina a few weeks later. He'd learned to speak some Russian by this time, and that was the language that he and Marina conversed in. Marina turned down Oswald's proposal at first, but just 6 weeks after meeting for the first time, the couple got married.
It would be appropriate now, Mr. Chairman, to call Mrs. Porter.
Committee calls Mrs. Porter.
In 1978, Marina Oswald, by now known as Marina Porter, went to Washington to testify before the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
Marina Oswald Porter, is entering the room accompanied by a battalion of marshals and police. She's wearing a beige skirt and is approaching the witness chair.
When we hear Marina speak at various times during this episode, the audio will come from the testimony that she gave to the House Select Committee in 1978. Some of her responses are a little hard to make out because of her heavy Russian accent, and the audio quality isn't all that great, but I think it's important that we hear from her directly, and when what she says is hard to hear, I'll repeat her words for the sake of clarity.
You knew him for barely 6 weeks, and you got married on April 30th, 1961.
Yeah.
But wasn't that a rather hasty move, hasty decision, after 6 weeks of knowing an individual?
Not when your age that I was, you don't think it is.
Not when you were the age that I was, you don't think it is, was what Marina said there. Cynical observers have speculated that Oswald may have married Marina for tactical reasons. It conceivably crossed his mind that if he returned to America with a Soviet wife, the US authorities would be reluctant to cause an international incident by pressing charges against him. Anyway, the couple got married, and in February 1962, Marina gave birth to their first daughter, whom they named June. In the summer of 1962, 18 months before the Kennedy assassination, Oswald was finally permitted to return to the US with Marina and June. They settled in Dallas, close to Oswald's mother and brother. On the ship home, Oswald wrote out a series of prepared answers to deal with the barrage of questions that he imagined America's reporters would greet him with when he disembarked. But the American press turned out to be far less interested in Oswald than he thought they'd be.
We met Oswald's in the summer of 1962, when we heard that there was a young couple who arrived from Russia and were in very difficult financial condition.
That's the voice of George de Morenschild, a worldly Russian expatriate who befriended Oswald and Marina after they settled in Dallas. He's speaking there in 1964, the year after the assassination. De Morenschild developed a certain affection for Oswald, but he took a dim view of his intellectual abilities. He was a semi-educated hillbilly, De Morenschild once said of Oswald. And he went on, his mind was of a man with exceedingly poor background who read rather advanced books and did not understand even the words in them. But there was always an element of pity that I had and my wife had for him. We realized that he was sort of a forlorn individual, groping for something. In spite of his pity for Oswald, de Morenschild was not a big fan of the way he treated Marina.
What's the thing I remember now? That he did not want Marina to learn English, maybe because he was an intensely jealous person. He did not want Marina to communicate with other people.
Jean de Morenschild, George's wife, noticed some even darker features of the Oswald marriage.
But it's rather difficult to discuss people's married life because what you see outside is not always goes on when you don't see the people.
That's Jean speaking in 1964.
But from what we knew, they weren't very happy. But for some particular reason, they both didn't want to leave each other. And we found out that Oswald was beating Marina.
In case you didn't catch that last bit, what Jean said was, we found out that Oswald was beating Marina. Along with other members of Dallas's Russian community, the de Morenschilds often saw Marina turn up to social functions, sporting black eyes and other bruises. Oswald was a vicious domestic tyrant. Among other things, he didn't like it when Marina smoked.
He was forbidding Marina to smoke, outright. We dropped by one evening to visit them, and then she went in the kitchen, and she came back quite upset. I said, what happened? She said, he just took cigarette out of my mouth and put it out on my shoulder.
As well as doing things like that, Oswald was a serial liar. He lied to Marina all the time about big things as well as small things. He lied even when his lies were bound to be exposed. It seemed to Marina that he liked secrecy for its own sake. She also thought that he had a wildly inflated sense of his own importance. "I think that he had a sick imagination," Marina said after the assassination. "In his imagination, his fantasy, which was quite unfounded, he was an outstanding man." Soon after settling in Dallas, Oswald found work at a printing firm. In his spare time, he used company equipment to forge fake IDs for himself, and he also made dummy posters advertising radical publications like The Worker, and sent off these samples of his work to the paper's editors in the hope that they would employ him as a kind of freelance propaganda man. Oswald may have given up on his dream of living in the Soviet Union, but he certainly hadn't given up on radical politics. Increasingly, his sights were turning to Fidel Castro's Cuba. Oswald thought that Cuba was the real deal. He thought it was the workers' paradise that the Soviet Union had turned out not to be. In January 1963, 6 months after settling in Dallas, Oswald mail-ordered a $30 Smith & Wesson revolver. He had decided that the time had come to try his hand at a political murder. Remember General Edwin Walker, the former U.S. Army general who mobilized his supporters to heckle and assault Adlai Stevenson when he came to Dallas?
Well, there's an enemy within this country, and of course it's the same enemy that represents the position that we should do away with the House Un-American Activities Committee, that we should destroy our local police forces, and that we should do away with our military forces. These are the, you might say, the anti-Americans as far as our traditions, heritage, and constitution are concerned, and there are plenty of them in this country in spite of the federal government's position that there is no threat from within. There is a threat from within.
That's General Walker doing his thing on a Dallas TV station in 1963. Walker was the most prominent right-wing hate monger in Dallas. And when Oswald set away for his $30 pistol, he was working on a plan to blow Edwin Walker away. He seems to have believed that if he assassinated Walker, he would turn himself into a folk hero of the American left. And not just the American left. There's evidence to suggest that Oswald believed that by assassinating General Walker, he could earn the respect of Fidel Castro himself. Walker was a fanatical opponent of Castro's regime. He once called on President Kennedy to send down a division of the U.S. Army to, quote, liquidate the scourge that has descended upon the island of Cuba. Unfortunately for Oswald, the mail order Smith & Wesson took an incredibly long time to ship. Oswald followed the news about General Walker very closely, and he knew that Walker was scheduled to leave Dallas in late February to go on a national speaking tour. He would be away from Dallas for 5 weeks, and it was starting to look as if Oswald's pistol wouldn't arrive before Walker left town. In his book Oswald's Tale, Norman Mailer has a memorable passage about how antsy Oswald must have felt as he waited for his pistol to arrive. Mailer writes, quote, "Oswald has but 11 days to get Walker and still no pistol. Nearly every day he goes to his post office box, but the notice is not there. It's like getting ready to make love without knowing if your phallus is in accord." End quote. As it turned out, the pistol didn't arrive in time, and Walker left Dallas unscathed to go off on his speaking tour, which he dubbed Operation Midnight Ride.
It's been interesting to note that as a result of our tour from coast to coast, there's been much response to what's been said on this tour. People are very much interested and quite upset across the land. It's very indicative that they are not being properly represented in Washington, D.C.
While Walker was out of town, Oswald went out to his house to do some reconnaissance work. He took photographs of the back windows and of an alley that ran behind the back fence. A few days after he conducted that surveillance mission, Oswald Mayle ordered a second gun, a high-powered Mannlicher Carcano military rifle with a telescopic sight. The retail price was $19.95. Oswald now had a new plan for the hit on Walker. He would position himself in the alley behind the house under cover of darkness, armed with the rifle, and he would take a shot at Walker through one of the lit back windows. Oswald had trained as a marksman in the Marines, and he knew his way around a rifle. By a coincidence, the pistol was finally shipped to Oswald on the same day the rifle was, March the 20th, 1963, and both weapons arrived on March the 25th.
Did you notice any change in his personality after he obtained his rifle?
Well, he liked to be alone by himself. Quite often that was a part of his personality. So that wasn't really anything new.
That's Marina again, testifying to the House Select Committee. What she said was, well, he liked to be alone by himself quite often. That was a part of his personality, so that wasn't really anything new.
But his behavior pattern towards me changed. He was very annoyed by me and seemed like I felt out of place.
But his behavior pattern toward me changed, Marina said there. He was very annoyed by me. It seemed like I felt out of place. Shortly after Oswald took delivery of his rifle, George and Jean de Morenschild paid a visit to the Oswald's apartment. Oswald had hidden the rifle in a closet, and Marina opened the door of the closet to show the weapon to Jean.
My wife and Marina were looking at the rifle which was inside of the closet, you know. And Marina said to my wife, look at that idiot, he has a rifle here. Instead of buying food or necessities for our home, you know, he bought a rifle.
That's George de Morenschild again, speaking in 1964. Look at that idiot, he has a rifle here, is what Marina said to Jean.
And it seemed to me like such a ridiculous idea for Oswald to buy a rifle when he needed money so desperately, you know, that it was just a big joke, you know.
On the night of April the 8th, General Walker got back to Dallas. The night before that, Oswald had taken his rifle out to Walker's neighborhood and he'd left it hidden somewhere near Walker's house, probably by concealing it in some bushes. One thing we need to know here is that Oswald didn't drive. He didn't have a car or a license. When he made his various trips to Edwin Walker's house, he went by bus. Marina would later say that he was in the habit of slipping out of their apartment with his rifle hidden under a long raincoat, ostensibly to go target shooting. Probably he used this same method to smuggle his rifle onto the bus that he caught to Walker's house on April the 7th. When he got back home that night, the rifle was no longer on him. At around 9 p.m. on the evening of April the 10th, 2 days after Walker returned to Dallas, the general was sitting at a desk in his dining room working on his tax return when he heard a loud crack and felt flying chips of wood and metal strike him in the face.
The general was sitting at his desk making out his income tax return. The bullet missed his head by inches, bore through a 9-inch wall, and settled in the adjoining room. Walker was spattered by wood and glass splinters, but not seriously hurt.
General, will you describe for us just what happened last night?
Well, the police from the city came in to investigate a rifle shot that was fired into the house, fired through the west window, and hit the sill and hit the wall across the room and went through the wall over the desk at which I was sitting.
Police here searching the yard the following morning determined the bullet came from a high-powered rifle not more than 75 yards away.
In fact, the shot was fired from a range of more like 40 yards. As Walker just said, the bullet struck a windowsill on the way in, which slightly altered its trajectory. If that hadn't happened, the bullet would almost certainly have passed through Walker's head instead of passing through the wall behind him. The Walker assassination attempt remained a mystery until just after the Kennedy assassination when Marina revealed that the shooter had been Oswald.
Directing your attention to that day, April 10th, 1963. Would you tell us what happened?
In 1978, Marina described the aftermath of the Walker incident to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. It goes without saying that her description of Oswald's behaviour that night gives us some important insights into the Kennedy assassination. The Walker incident was Oswald's first attempt to assassinate an American public figure. 7 months after missing Walker, he successfully shot Kennedy with the same rifle. The Walker incident makes it very hard to doubt that Oswald did that, and it also gives us some large clues as to why he did it. Again, the audio of Marina's voice here is quite scratchy, but given that she was the only eyewitness to what Oswald said and did on the night of the Walker shooting, I think it's important that we hear from her directly. And for the sake of clarity, I'm going to repeat what she says as she goes.
That particular night, he did not come home until very late. He was very pale, as I said, and he was out of breath.
That particular night, he did not come home till very late. He was very pale, as I said, and he was out of breath.
And I was asking, I asked him to explain and asked him what happened, and he said that he just tried to shoot General Walker.
And I asked him to explain. I asked him what happened, and he said that he just tried to shoot General Walker.
Asked him who General Walker was. I mean, how dare you to go and claim somebody's life? And he said, well, what would you say if somebody got rid of Hitler at the right time?
I asked him who General Walker was. I mean, how dare you to go and claim somebody's life? And he said, well, what would you say if somebody got rid of Hitler at the right time?
Because he told me that he wasn't... He said he was supposed, something equal to... Well, he called him a fascist. That's what he put in his description.
And he told me that he was something equal to... Well, he called him a fascist. That was his description. As Oswald breathlessly told Marina what he'd done that night, he still wasn't sure if his shot had hit Walker or missed him. He hadn't stuck around at the scene to find out. Only the next morning did he hear on the radio that Walker was still alive and well. Then, said Marina, he was, quote, kind of angry that he missed. Conspiracy theorists like to claim that Marina was simply lying when she said incriminating things like this about Oswald. But we don't just have to take her word for it that Oswald tried to kill Walker. There's solid physical evidence that backs her account up. When he went out that night to do the deed, Oswald left Marina a handwritten note in Russian that advised her what to do in the event of his death or capture, and she kept that note. Oswald also made the mistake of keeping some of the surveillance photos that he'd taken while staking out Walker's house. Marina urged him to destroy these, but Oswald said that he wanted to hold on to them as, quote, a keepsake. We're lucky that he did, because after the Kennedy assassination, these photographs surfaced, and they added themselves to the towering pile of evidence that conspiracy theorists have to jump over if they want to argue that Oswald wasn't a serial perpetrator of political gun violence. The story of the Kennedy assassination is full of sliding door moments. Moments when Kennedy's fate came down to a matter of inches one way or the other, and history came very close to taking a different path. The Walker shooting is probably the most dramatic of these sliding door moments. If Oswald's bullet had hit and killed Walker, it's vastly unlikely that he would have gone on to kill Kennedy. In fact, it's unlikely that the idea of killing Kennedy would even have crossed Oswald's mind if he had scratched his assassination itch by killing General Walker. But in the universe that we happen to live in, the bullet that Oswald fired at Walker grazed the window frame, and Walker lived. And Oswald, instead of becoming a successful assassin, went on being an embittered and resentful failure. 14 days after the Walker incident, Oswald abruptly left Dallas and moved to New Orleans. The move mainly came at the insistence of Marina, who was terrified that Oswald would try to take another shot at Walker. She'd made him promise that he wouldn't, but she feared, no doubt correctly, that if he stayed in Dallas, he would be tempted to break that promise. A rifle for him was not a very good toy, she said later. It was a toy that was too enticing. Oswald set out for New Orleans alone. Marina and June would join him there later once he'd found a job and an apartment. For the moment, they stayed in Dallas, where they moved in with a generous local woman named Ruth Payne.
I met them through friends at a party last winter, and then saw more of Marina later.
That's Ruth Payne being interviewed in 1963, just 2 days after Kennedy's assassination. Ruth was learning to speak Russian when she met Marina, and she was happy to have found someone she could practice speaking the language with. She'd also recently separated from her husband, and she was grateful for Marina's companionship. In May, when Oswald had settled in New Orleans, Ruth Payne drove Marina and June out there to join him. The Oswalds would remain in New Orleans for another 5 months. They wouldn't return to Dallas until late September, that is 2 months before Kennedy was assassinated there. Oswald's 5-month stay in New Orleans was typically action-packed and full of psychodrama. By now, Marina was pregnant with their second child. The baby was due in October, but as usual, Oswald had higher things on his mind. In New Orleans, he quickly got restless again, and before long, the restlessness morphed into obsession. This time, the object of his obsession was Cuba.
You mentioned his interest in Cuba. Had he mentioned it before he went to New Orleans, or was this something that he became interested in New Orleans?
I think in New Orleans, the word Cuba came up much more often than in Dallas.
I think in New Orleans, the word Cuba came up much more often than in Dallas, Marina says.
Could you tell us just a little bit more about that and about what he might have said about Fidel Castro and why he wanted to go there?
Well, I knew for a long time that Fidel Castro was his hero. He was a great admirer of him. I mean, he would be happy to work for Fidel Castro causes or something like that.
Well, I knew for a long time that Fidel Castro was his hero, Marina says. He was a great admirer of him, and that he would be happy to work for Fidel Castro causes or something like that. In fact, Oswald didn't just want to work for the cause of Fidel Castro. He had visions of going to Havana and working for Castro personally. He saw himself becoming a key member of the Castro regime. Marina was skeptical about Oswald's Cuban fantasies. I am sure that if he had gone there, she said later, he would not have liked it there either. Only on the moon, perhaps. Which is about the best summary of Oswald's character I've ever heard. This is a man who would have been happy only on the moon, perhaps. I would make fun of him, Marina remembered. I would say that Lee could not really do much for Cuba, that Cuba would get along well without him if they had to. As Marina recalled, Oswald replied to that jibe by saying, "You laugh now, but in 20 years when I'm Prime Minister, we'll see how you laugh then." Oswald's behaviour during the New Orleans period became increasingly ominous. At night, he would sit out on the porch with his rifle, looking at imaginary targets through the scope. He would dry fire the weapon and practice working its bolt. Sometimes he snuck out at night to go target shooting. When Marina finally asked him what he was up to, he told her that he was planning to hijack a plane to Cuba. In fact, he wanted Marina to participate in that operation too. He planned to buy another pistol for her, a lighter one, so that she could threaten the plane's passengers with it while Oswald himself was busy dealing with the pilot.
How did the discussion come about regarding hijacking a plane? In other words, did he approach you, and what did he say?
Well, he asked me for my cooperation to help him to hijack a plane.
Well, what did he want you to do?
Well, it was so ridiculous, it's even embarrassing to mention it right now. He asked, he told me that he will teach me what I'm supposed to say. You know, maybe hold the gun and tell the people, you know, that...
Well, it was so ridiculous, it's even embarrassing to mention it right now, said Marina there. He told me that he would teach me what I'm supposed to say, maybe hold the gun and tell the people, you know, that... And Marina trails off there, having observed correctly that this is all very embarrassing. As we know, Oswald had previously gone to great lengths to stop Marina from learning to speak English so that she'd be unable to communicate with any Americans except him. But when it came to his hijacking operation, Oswald was ready to make an exception. He tried to teach Marina how to say the phrase, stick 'em up, in English.
Did he mention any particular airline or any particular flight?
No. It was just a general idea that he was toying with.
And what did he say, or what did you say in response to all of this?
Well, first of all, I refused, and I tried to make him to see how it will look very funny to people. Here I was, pregnant with a child, you know, it doesn't look very scary.
First of all, I refused. And I tried to make him see how it will look very funny to people. Here I was, pregnant with a child, you know. It doesn't look very scary. When Marina refused to serve as Oswald's sidekick on the plane hijacking, he toyed with the idea of going ahead with the plan alone. He did training exercises in their little apartment, jumping around the place in his underwear, then rubbing himself down with liniment. But Oswald ultimately shelved the hijacking idea and decided that he would try to get to Cuba peacefully by applying for a visa. This still wouldn't be easy, though. The US government had severed diplomatic ties with Cuba after the Cuban Revolution in 1959, and since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, US citizens hadn't been permitted to travel there. So Oswald developed the following plan. He would present himself at the nearest Cuban embassy, which was located down in Mexico City. There he would apply for a Cuban transit visa, claiming that he was on his way to the Soviet Union and that he intended to transit through Cuba en route. And once he'd landed in Cuba, Oswald planned to stay there for good. Maybe he would then arrange for Marina and June to come and join him there, but this didn't seem to be an essential component of his plan. In preparation for his trip to the Cuban embassy in Mexico City, Oswald started putting together a written record of his history as a left-wing man of action. He listed his defection to Russia and his pro-Cuban political activities in New Orleans and his work as a, quote, lecturer and street agitator. Back in 1959, when he'd applied for Soviet citizenship in Moscow, the Soviets had asked to see papers that proved his credentials, and Oswald had had nothing to show them. So he was determined that this time he wouldn't be caught short if the Cubans demanded to see any paperwork down at their embassy. To bulk out this written resume of his, Oswald embarked on a frenzied campaign of left-wing activity in New Orleans. He wrote letters to radical newspapers, he staged pro-Fidel street protests, he picked fights with local Cuban exiles. He did radio interviews. He got his name into the local newspapers. And he put all the relevant clippings and documents into his steadily fattening CV. As for Marina and June, the plan was to pack them off to Dallas to live with Ruth Payne again while Oswald did the business down in Mexico City. Oswald promised Marina that they would then be reunited in Cuba, or at worst, in Russia. But Marina had a strong suspicion that Oswald would just vanish into Cuba and she would never see him again.
What was your reaction to this whole affair, going to Mexico City and going back to Dallas?
I was very upset about it. I did not know if I ever see Lee again.
Marina also thought that Oswald's timing was a tad selfish. given that their second baby was due in just a month. On September the 20th, Ruth Payne arrived in New Orleans in her station wagon to take Marina and June back to Dallas. Ruth was impressed by the way Oswald insisted on packing Marina's stuff into the car by himself, refusing all offers of help. She thought that he was being a real gentleman. It was only when Kennedy was shot a couple of months later that Ruth realized what Oswald had been up to. He'd wanted to pack his rifle into Ruth's station wagon without her seeing it. As Oswald slyly packed the car, somebody else was watching him with interest too. His landlady.
And the same station wagon from Texas, the lady that brought him there, came back. And they packed the stuff, put it in the station wagon. The station wagon was there for a few days.
Oswald still owed the landlady a month's rent, and it looked to her like he was about to skip town without paying it.
And I told my husband, I said, they're packing the station wagon. It looks like they're taking everything, so go find out if he's moving. So he did, and he said, no, he wasn't moving. He was only sending his wife to Texas to have the baby.
On Monday, September the 23rd, Marina and June left for Texas in Ruth Payne's station wagon. Marina noticed that Oswald was fighting back tears as he said goodbye.
When he left for Mexico City, when you both parted in New Orleans,
yes.
When did you expect to see him again?
I honestly did not expect to see him again, Marina said there. After Marina and June were gone, Oswald stayed on in New Orleans for a couple more days, and then in the small hours of September the 25th, he slipped out of his apartment carrying two suitcases, leaving the place empty and confirming his landlady's worst fears.
And that night, evidently he left through the night, owing us rent. He didn't pay us, just skipped town.
The next day, September the 26th, Oswald crossed the Mexican border by bus. This happened to be the same day that newspapers in Dallas revealed that President Kennedy planned to visit the city in November. Oswald not only wasn't in Dallas to hear that news, he wasn't even in the United States, and he seemed to have no intention of ever returning. But Oswald's trip to Mexico City was a washout. At the Cuban embassy, he applied for a 15-day transit visa, claiming that he planned to visit the country briefly before proceeding to the Soviet Union. But the embassy staff shocked Oswald by telling him that he would have to wait the standard 2 to 3 weeks for his visa, unless he could get a Soviet visa first. Oswald threw a tantrum. He argued with the Cuban consul, who wound up telling him that, far from being a friend of the Cuban Revolution, he was behaving like an enemy of it. Oswald stormed out, and he marched over to the nearby Soviet embassy. He told the staff there how important he was. He hinted that he would have some big secrets to tell the authorities in Moscow if they agreed to not only grant him a visa, but also to pick up the tab for his journey to Russia. But the staff at the Soviet embassy blew off Oswald too, telling him that he would have to wait the standard 4 months for his application to be processed. The next day, Oswald shuttled comically between the Cuban and Soviet embassies, still getting no joy, throwing a few more tantrums, and giving the staff at both places the distinct impression that he was an unstable crackpot. After a humiliating week in Mexico, Oswald returned to America with his tail between his legs. He went to Dallas, took a room at the YMCA, and started looking for a job. Within a couple of weeks, he'd rented a tiny room in a boarding house in the Dallas suburb of Oak Cliff. Marina was happy living with Ruth Payne and was in no rush to move back in with Oswald. By now, she'd had her second baby, a girl named Audrey. On October the 16th, a little over a month before the Kennedy assassination, Oswald found a job. He was hired as a stock boy at the Texas Schoolbook Depository, a 7-story fulfillment center in downtown Dallas, where school textbooks were warehoused and shipped out to customers. Oswald would be earning $1.25 an hour. This might be an appropriate moment in the story to pause and say something about the counterclaims of conspiracy theory. I doubt there are many conspiracy theorists still listening to this podcast. I probably lost that demographic about 10 seconds after I started talking. But if any conspiracy theorists have made it this far, I bet they'll have spent the last 50 minutes or so emitting various groans and yodels of protest. Because there's hardly a fact I've mentioned so far that conspiracy theorists wouldn't vigorously dispute. They will tell you that Oswald wasn't a real left-winger at all. They'll tell you he was a right-winger posing as a left-winger. Or they'll tell you that if he was a real left-winger, he was a naive innocent who was cynically pushed around the chessboard by the CIA and the military-industrial complex. They'll tell you that Oswald never took a shot at General Edwin Walker. They'll tell you he was framed for that crime, just as he was framed for the shooting of the president. They'll tell you that it wasn't the real Oswald who visited the Cuban and Soviet embassies in Mexico City. They'll tell you that it was an imposter who was out to give Oswald a bad name. They'll tell you that nearly every single witness I've quoted so far, from Ruth Payne to Marina Oswald to George and Jean de Morenschild, was a liar and possibly a CIA operative. According to the conspiracists, everybody in this story is evil and guilty except for Oswald himself. They'll tell you that everything I've told you so far is merely the official story, as if by putting the word story in scare quotes, they can make a mountain range of solid facts just go away. In future episodes of this podcast, I'm going to engage with those kinds of complaints. I'm going to explain how we know what we know about Oswald. I'm going to demonstrate that I believe the so-called official story, not because I'm naive or gullible or believe what other people tell me to believe. I believe it because it's clearly true, according to all the best evidence we have. I'll be talking about all that evidence in detail when the time comes. Trust me, we'll be getting to the ballistics, the Zapruder film, the grassy knoll, the autopsy, the single bullet theory, and the Warren Commission. We'll talk about all that stuff as the podcast goes on, and we'll talk in detail about the counterclaims of the conspiracy theorists, and we'll see just how well they stand up to scrutiny. Before we go too deeply into the conspiracy theories, though, I want to finish telling the basic story of what the evidence says happened in Dallas. The conspiracy theorists can tell you all sorts of stories about what didn't happen there, but I don't think there's much point talking about what didn't happen until we have a solid understanding of what did. If we enter the world of conspiracy theory too soon, before we've equipped ourselves with a basic map of reality, we might never get out. Which is exactly what the conspiracy theorists want, of course. Conspiracy theorists are always looking to drag us off the fairway and into the weeds. They want us to join them there forever. They don't want us to get to the cup of understanding and sink the putt and move on to the next hole. They don't want us to absorb truths that they disapprove of. They want us to doubt things, not know things. That might sound like a strange way of putting it, because surely one thing you can say about the conspiracy theorists is that they do seem to know an awful lot about this case. They could talk about it under wet cement. They can tell you all about the millimeter-long discrepancies in the autopsy measurements and the missing bullet fragment that weighs about a tenth as much as a postage stamp. But the things the conspiracy theorists know about always turn out to be minuscule and peripheral and unconnected. They don't add up to anything coherent. They don't go anywhere. Out there in the conspiratorial weeds, there's never been a complete theory about Kennedy's murder that makes sense and that's stood the test of time. All there has ever been is a ceaseless, obsessive picking away at the loose ends of history, a blizzard of micro-quibbles that have never led anywhere except round and round and round in a circle that keeps getting smaller and smaller, so that by now it looks very much like a futile little full stop. after 60 years of picking away at the supposedly ridiculous official story, the conspiracy theorists still haven't reached any clear agreement even among themselves about what happened in Dallas, which is a pretty major failure when you think about it, because something certainly happened in Dallas. Somebody shot Kennedy. That much we can surely all agree on. But after 6 decades of thinking about almost nothing else, the conspiracy theorists still can't tell you who it was. They can tell you all about how improbable the official story is, but they've never come within a bull's roar of constructing an alternative explanation of the evidence that's even physically possible, let alone more probable than the explanation we already have. Anyway, if there's one thing this case teaches us, it's that history is under no obligation to strike us as probable. It just happens. We're free not to like the way it happens, but we're not free to change it. Or at least we shouldn't be. To put all that another way, in order to understand the conspiracy theories about this case, we first have to understand the truth that they're rebelling against. The truth that they couldn't exist without, in fact. Think of it in terms of clothing. Let's say you've got a well-cut suit that fits you perfectly and has never looked like wearing out. And let's say that there are a few loose threads on it here and there, a couple on the sleeve, one or two on the leg. What do you do about that? You brush off the threads and you move on, right? You don't sit there in the nude for 60 years looking at the loose threads under a microscope. You don't throw the suit away and try to make a new one out of the loose threads. If you do, the results are bound to look preposterous. Anyway, I promise that we'll be zeroing in on all the loose ends of this case when the time comes, and we'll be looking at the various weird garments that people have fashioned them into over the years. But before we go there, let's finish talking about the perfectly good suit that these loose threads are really just a meaningless byproduct of. Over the next couple of episodes, I'm going to do what the conspiracy theorists in this case have never been able to do. I'm going to finish telling the basic story of what happened in a straightforward, logical, coherent, beginning-to-end way. I want to tell a story that goes with the grain of all the best evidence we have, instead of picking and choosing from the scraps pile. I'm going to tell a story that doesn't shatter the laws of common sense or violate our normal understanding of the way the world works and the way real people actually behave. And the longer we stay focused on the straightforward, not very sensational story of what the facts say happened in this case, the more we're going to see that conspiracy theory just isn't required here. There's no need for it. And as I said back at the beginning of this episode, one thing I want to stress in this podcast is that if the evidence doesn't require us to believe something, we shouldn't believe it. In the next episode of the podcast, we're going to talk in detail about the day of Kennedy's death. For now, I want to freeze frame the action on November the 19th, 1963. This was a Tuesday, 3 days before the assassination. And it was the day the Dallas newspapers announced the route that Kennedy's motorcade would be taking through the city on the coming Friday. The presidential limousine would be coming straight past the Texas Schoolbook Depository at low speed, after slowing to an almost dead halt to make the hairpin turn from Houston Street onto Elm. Back in March, in a letter to his brother, Oswald had written, "It's always better to take advantage of your chances as they come along." Conspiracy theorists have always claimed that Oswald had no discernible motive to kill Kennedy. But once you know a bit about the kind of person Oswald was, it isn't hard to imagine the sick thrill that must have passed through him when fate invited him to take advantage of this particular chance. The most powerful man in the world was coming to Dallas, and he would be moving at low speed, in broad daylight, right past the 7-story building where Oswald worked. It must have been a strange feeling for Oswald when he heard the news, half exhilaration and half dread, because he must have known at once that he would have no real option but to smuggle his rifle into the building somehow and at least take a shot at the man as he came by. If Oswald spurned this freakish opportunity to impose himself on the American story, he would have to spend the rest of his life thinking of himself as a complete coward and failure. Up until this moment, his life had been a series of disappointments and fiascos. He'd always considered himself an extraordinary human being, despite the mounting evidence that he wasn't one. He always saw himself as a man of destiny, a player in world affairs. When he told Marina that he would be Prime Minister of Cuba one day, she had mocked him to his face. "I always tried to point out to him," she said, "that he was a man like any others who were around us, but he simply could not understand that." If Oswald had any sense of reality at all, though, by late 1963, he must have been starting to fear that Marina had been right about him all along. He'd tried and failed to make it in Russia. He had tried and failed to make it to Cuba. He had tried and failed to assassinate one powerful American political figure. His marriage was on the skids, along with his imaginary career as a globe-trotting revolutionary. He was washed up at the age of 24. But now fate had dropped this colossal opportunity in his lap. The American president was coming to him. There's no evidence to suggest that the thought of killing Kennedy had ever seriously crossed Oswald's mind until he heard that the presidential motorcade would be coming straight past the depository's windows. But for a homicidal man with a high-powered rifle and delusions of grandeur, the thought must have pretty much completed itself. It must have felt like a no-brainer. For once in his life, Oswald had been visited by an incredible stroke of luck. For Kennedy and for America, the luck was bad. You could even say the luck was bad for Oswald too, because the die was cast for him as well when the route of the presidential motorcade was announced. Like Kennedy himself, Oswald now had less than a week to live.
Where did he work in the building? On the same floor?
He had access on all floors, and therefore he had access, perfectly proper access, to the 5th floor and to the 6th floor.
Did anybody hear, see him on the 5th floor?
Yes, he was seen on the 5th floor by one of the workmen. There before the assassination took place, he was seen there.